today. So that we're absolutely clear where I'm going, in case this is a paper that has a middle eight where it's less clear. The argument is simply in the title. All I want to argue is that the tradition of martyrs' cults and the hagiography associated with martyrs' cults feeds into how people think about missionary work towards the end of the 7th century, going into the 8th century. And I think this is something which has been neglected. There's a sense that there's a missionary turn at the end of the 7th century, both in hagiography and through the influence of Columbanian networks. And I'm not going to deny that that's important. But I think that there's a longer-standing tradition of interest in martyrs' cults which feeds into that, that I think that's been neglected. So that's simply what I'm going to try and sketch out today. The rise of a hagiography of mission matters in European history. The development of a concept of universal mission to all peoples, developed only in the 7th century as a reflex of the papacy's struggles to redefine itself and a Roman Empire in crisis, combined with the cultural paradigm shift stimulated by the involvement of Irish and English peregrini in Frankish lands. The result was a relatively rapid expansion of Christian infrastructure, which provided mechanisms for cultural integration between the regional blocs coarsely defined as Roman Christian and German pagan, divided by the Rhine and Danube. Hagiography played a crucial role in articulating stories which defined the new communities on both sides, how they had come into the Christian universal, who the heroes of the drama were, what had been won, and which places had come to symbolise tradition. Historians might still see fit to debate many of the details and nuances, but perhaps most of us can agree about this overview. Some of those details and nuances can still be revealing. In Ian Wood's 2001 study of hagiographies about mission, under his own criteria, he had difficulty finding much relevant material from before circa 680. Most hagiographers and historians in the Latin West before then did not seem to value mission in the same way as later writers, so there were fewer individuals or texts defined by efforts at evangelisation. This, of course, gelled with Wolfgang Fritzer's 1969 argument that mission changed in the 7th century. We're used to everything changing in the 7th century. But such arguments can gloss over continuities. And here, for example, Martin Heinzelmann has recently reminded us that by concentrating on the great confessors, we have lost sight of the widespread and persistent interest in martyrs' cults which dominated in the Merovingian age. Many celebrated martyrs met their fate during or after mission, so this is relevant. What happens then if we view the rise of a hagiography mission from the perspective of the wider body of texts and compilations which framed this development? Unsurprisingly, we will find a more continuous hagiographical tradition with which missionaries themselves engage. I want to start by thinking about the context, the actual physical contexts that we find some of these stories. A return to the manuscripts can help us to reframe some of the issues involved. Patrick Geary suggested in 1994 that paying attention to which hagiographies travel together could be deeply revealing of varying attitudes and associations. Passionaries have been much studied in this way before 1994 and since. The poor survival rate of manuscripts, at least in certain senses, alas, skews the kind of conclusions that can be drawn for any analysis here. Moreover, one is hard-pushed ever to find two collections of saints' lives which have lots of material in common. They are very different. It makes typologies of material quite haphazard. One feature, however, is striking. Rarely do we find the texts we might readily define as hagiographies copied alongside texts other than more hagiographies. The impression is that early medieval scriptoria were able to perceive of hagiography as a distinct overarching class. The theme of coherence and universality, which run through these early collections of hagiography, create things by juxtaposing different lives. I'll take the example of one of the oldest extant ones, Paris Bibliothèque Nationale, Latin 12598, a manuscript from circa 800, probably provenance Corbie. This has a cluster of Merovingian vitae concerning Remigius of Rome, Medard of Noyon, Vedastus of Arras, and they sit together following a dossier on St. Martin of Tours and preceding a collection of Gallic passiones about the persecution era, martyrs and confessors together. There is no sense that the status of the saints described is necessarily different, and together they mutually reinforce the sanctity of each individual concerned by placing the older and more recent figures together. This is particularly evident in the treatment of the most recent martyr saint represented, Saint Lambert of Maastricht, who died about 705. A partial copy of the Vita Landiberti was inserted into this collection alongside a Vita of St. Servatius in Maastricht from an earlier 8th century manuscript, probably from Maastricht itself. And whereupon the partial Vita was then completed, and the completed section was augmented by 7 stories of virgin martyrs and Constantius of Leon's Vita Germani. Such mixing of different types of saints, different sexes, different regions, martyrs, confessors, virgins, softens the distinctions between them by establishing them in a common textual body of saintliness. In the process, it creates archives of intertextuality, which actively facilitate understanding themes, motifs, and stories which work across the different texts, as well as within each individual one. The evidence of Pseudo-Jerome's Martyrologium provides a different kind of example in which the sufferings of saints were celebrated as a collective whole, and our best evidence for this suggests it has collections with the Columbanian networks of the early 7th century. The purpose of the martyrology was to provide the names of saints to be celebrated on each day as a collective, with little more detail than where they were killed or buried. Liturgically, it was a relative of the litany, which also thrived in the Sanctorum Nominum Festivitas, without need for historical narrative. It has been argued that the Martyrologium lent itself well to mission because Pseudo-Jerome included 2 short texts on the apostles, which included references to work in the West. The text also circulated in the Luxeuil-centred milieu, interested in evangelisation, and found their ways into the libraries of circles of English missionaries, including Willibrord and Boniface. The missionary element of the text might be exaggerated, given that Pseudo-Jerome's compilers and later editors never in any way developed any statement about mission. Indeed, one of the most striking features of the work is how it strips away historical narrative action to leave just a name and a place. So again, missionary martyrs stand no differently to any other kind of saint. But even this conclusion is still useful for understanding interest in mission intersecting with a conceptual framework defined by death as the proof of God's power. There are 2 important points here. First, many missionaries were responding directly to this martyrological material. Saint Boniface's letters contain a reference to Passionis Martyrum he could not obtain, but clearly knew about, and which Hermann Schuling plausibly suggested might be connected to 2 passionaries now in the Würzburg Library. As Katie Kubit put it, Boniface's martyrdom in 754, while engaged in mission, was the culmination of a lifetime of reading. Our second point, many of our archetypal hagiographies about mission circulated as part of these passionaries with a mix of saints. This is true of the 2 earliest Vitae Amandi, Willibald's Vita Bonifaci, the Passio Minorciliani, to name just a few obvious early examples. Mission predominantly remained part of a bigger picture, a universal picture of Christendom, even as it grew in a theme of its own right. To say that it came out of an indebtedness to the Gregorian Iro-Frankish matrix may be true, but it may also be to look at things with too narrow a focus. How can we move forward? I'd encourage us to think about missionary narrative episodes within the texts, as well as looking at these kind of manuscript collections. An important aspect we need to remember is that while there was no hagiography about mission before 680, mission was still present as a typical narrative episode in the experience of many martyrs. Mission was simply part of a repertoire of saintly behaviour. With this in mind, we begin to see how missionary hagiography grew out of martyr stories and why even Saint Boniface as a martyr could not be, in Ian Wood's view, a fully realised missionary saint. Mission was certainly low on the agendas of early Merovingian writers. It is natural to start by looking at Gregory of Tours for all his idiosyncrasies. The apostles of Gaul are mentioned in his famous 10 books of history, but they simply do not have much of a presence. This is not to say that their evangelical work was not important. Gregory had 2 distinct interests. First, he was careful to point out the holy origins of many churches in his own day. And second, he wished to highlight the power of the old martyrs in the present, when there was no ongoing mission. Take the example of Saint Dionysius. In the Historia, Gregory mentions his place as one of the seven apostles of Gaul, who received martyrdom. But beyond that brief note, what we hear about is Saint-Denis as a great church, and in the Gloria Martyrum, a story about someone in King Sigebert's army who died horribly after trying to steal gems from Saint Dionysius' sepulchre. He falls down and crushes his bollocks and then impales himself on his own spear. But of course, to Gregory, the story of Dionysius had already been told elsewhere by another writer, on whom more in a moment. And his job was to talk about why the saint mattered in his own day. Gregory's works are alive with the potential of intertextuality. Mission and martyrdom preceded Gregory's story. It's not that he was uninterested in them. If we turn to these other kinds of texts, it is readily apparent that mission was a common precursor to martyrdom in this historical thought world, the late 6th century. In that 6th century, we find Apasio, Dionysi, Rustici, and Oletheri introducing the principal hero setting off from Rome to evangelise the peoples around Paris in a missionary peregrinatio before the 7th century missionary peregrinationes. It is a standard entry in the glorious failure of martyr stories. After converting many and destroying pagan shrines, the missionaries were seized by a crowd and murdered. This was to establish a narrative which celebrated the foundation and power of the Church of Saint-Denis, where the bodies were buried after their retrieval by a woman named Catula. Similar stories were told in the Rictiovarus cycle of Passiones from the 6th and 7th centuries. Prominent amongst these subjects was Saint Quentin, a Roman who was executed on the orders of Rictiovarus for preaching to pagans during the persecutions of Maximian, and whose burial site was the focus of a church after a woman named Eusebia had obtained the body. Not all stories promoted aggression and preaching, and that of Crispin and Crispinian of Soissons saw the two brothers attracting people to the faith by distributing the profits of their cobbling business to the poor, before again it upset Rictiovarus and they were tortured and killed, paving the way once more for a story about the retrieval of bodies and the foundation of a new church. Mission led to martyrdom, led to church foundation. And if the examples are all rather northern, well, we can actually find similar patterns in the hagiography from Burgundy and the Auvergne too, but I will, for pressures of space, leave that to one side. New texts and models subverted the simplicity of this narrative. The new Iro-Frankish paradigm inaugurated by Columbanus perhaps stands tallest here, given the importance of Luxeuil in revitalising missionary work. Non-martyr Columbanus himself was in a sense a missionary in Alemannia during one of his many exiles, and his hagiographer Jonas said so. But the story was almost as peripheral to the career of Columbanus as St. Wilfrid's famous accidental mission passing through Frisia had been, something to mention, but not actually important to the overall plot. Mission had to be conducted with care as part of a process of consolidation, not as a glory-seeking mission. Jonas himself worked as a missionary in the Scheldt Basin alongside St. Amandus of Maastricht, but he also told of how Eustasius of Luxeuil had warned the unruly Agrestius not to engage in evangelisation because he was not of sufficient dignity and rank. Martyrdom and mission were being separated, and the new current spreading from Columbanian monasticism problematised the picture even as they stimulated mission. As a hagiographical character, Amandus himself blurred the divide between the old martyrs and Columbanus by spending most of his career allegedly yearning for a martyrdom which never came. According to his earliest hagiographers, Amandus was inspired to attempt to evangelise the most northerly Franks, the Basques, and even some Slavs, after receiving a vision of St. Peter while in Rome. The stories provide some of the earliest examples of missionary episodes dominating a saintly narrative. The extant hagiography is also not short of passages reminiscent of the Vita Bonifacii, although it could be that Willibald was influenced rather than influential here. There may have been a Vita Amandi written as early as circa 700, which makes it important that Amandus was said to have been prepared for martyrdom as he crossed the Danube. Indeed, it was something which he had always sought, quote unquote. He was said to have actively desired it when Bishop Mamelanus of Zeh tried to have him murdered in order to displace him at the court of Childeric II, who died in 675. And even the mission around the Scheldt had been conducted under constant threat of violence. And it was visiting the shrines of the apostles and martyrs in Rome which inspired his missionary turn in the first place. While the vitae about Amandus might represent something new in terms of the dominance of mission, it did so in a way which was still rooted in the older imaginary space of martyrdom and tribulation. The intellectual landscape here was complicated by more than one approach to the importance of martyrs in the Merovingian world. Gregory of Tours had already opened up a potential can of worms by declaring that people could be considered martyrs for resisting vice, so minimising the importance of the spectacular death. Amandus' contemporary, Audouin of Rouen, reported that Pope Martin, murdered in exile during the Monothelite dispute, had proclaimed that it was better to become a martyr fighting against heresy than it was to die smashing idols. Fighting pagans was selfish. Was the inclusion of this story somehow a criticism of Amandus, who had desired this martyrdom? Audouin presents his own hagiographical hero, his friend Eligius of Noyon, as someone just as keen on martyrdom and as a bishop with missionary interests. But Eligius very much fought his battles on his own doorstep, venturing out into the countryside, but not crossing borders dangerously. This was part of a battle for Christianisation. This was not the action of a wandering holy man. Unlike Amandus, Eligius was a keen builder and rebuilder of shrines to martyr saints, harnessing the power of those earlier generations of martyrs, including Dionysius, Quentin, Crispin, and Crispinianus. Crucially, he did not have to imitate those saints or to reject them. The point of Gregory and of Martin was simple but powerful. The Christian life had to be lived responsibly and in relation to present challenges, even in relation to mission to outsider people. This Merovingian discourse about martyrdom and responsibility starts to put a different spin on the political martyrdoms that famously dominated the late 7th and early 8th century. Here, no one took on the mantle of missionary and martyr, not even the unfortunate and famous Hugh the Black and Hugh the White, who were murdered for preaching in Germany without licence. But already, as Audouin was circulating his vita, Proiectus of Clermont and Ludegard of Autun were martyred in the course of a land dispute and intrigue at court, having otherwise stood, at least retrospectively, as model bishops, interested, of course, in their own martyrs' cults locally. A similar case is presented by Lambert of Maastricht, whose hagiography, inspired directly by Audouin's work, portrayed his subject as an active bishop with a missionary sideline who just happened to fall victim to a revenge killing. This was martyrdom in the alternative sense of being the struggle for standards. In the complex world of late Merovingian politics, the idea of a martyr had been reclaimed to say something poignant about the problems of society. The founding of new holy places must have seemed a distant concern, and martyrdom and mission had, in a sense, departed ways. I'd like to wind this up with a Boniface conclusion. The career and sanctification of Saint Boniface played out squarely in relation to many of the martyrial themes of the Merovingian age. He had read the stories of martyrs of old and knew that to be like them, he would have to endure suffering. His decision when extremely old in the middle of the 8th century to leave the security of his bishopric in Mainz to become a missionary well beyond Christian frontiers in Frisia reads like an attempt to live up to the older models like Saint Dionysius. Maybe he was frustrated by the standards of his own day and needed to make a point. Maybe he just understood the power of these old models. Still, Willibald's Vita Bonifati, written shortly after Boniface's death, seemingly played to Merovingian sensibilities. The pro-German missionary of the letter collections that known so well was redefined in hagiography as a Columbanian-style wanderer interested in universal mission, relevant to audiences in Britain, Gaul, Germany, and, allegedly, Tuscany. There was even a post-martyrdom inventio of sorts, which legitimised the translation of Boniface's body from the missionary frontier to the woodland desert of Fulda. As a fully hagiographised character, Boniface inspired further meditation on mission and martyrdom, notably in the Passio Ciliani, I've already mentioned. And in keeping with the theme that definitions were readily redefinable, early manuscripts show that the Vita Bonifatii could be combined with text to provide a narrative of the Christianization of northwest Bavaria. Or it could be combined with the lives of church fathers to make Boniface less of a modern saint and more part of a longer-term collective. Or it could just be combined with a random assortment of Merovingian hagiographies and confessors. The logic of the martyr saint was not static and had different meaning wherever you went. What have we gained by looking at mission in this wider context of interest in martyrs? Above all, we can determine a stronger continuity in a hagiographical tradition between 558 and 800 than if we look at the famous confessors and the missionary turn in isolation. In the process, we can see that the missionary turn is less dramatic than it might at first appear. It just doesn't suddenly emerge out of nowhere in Kirke 680, because it stands as a development of missionary ideas already current in martyrial literature. As witnesses, martyrs stand at the core of conversion and Christianisation, supplying power, proof of God's, and the sacred topography through churches. As role models, they show the value of people travelling far and wide in order to preach and inspire. Again, missionary pilgrimage before missionary pilgrimage. In the 1960s, Friedrich Prinz and Wolfgang Fritzer saw that there was a real change in spirit connected to the confluence of Gregorian and Iro-Frankish ideals in the 7th century. By taking seriously Heinzelmann's encouragement to look at Merovingian hagiography altogether, we can begin to see that this development was rooted in a textual tradition which transcended both of these streams of influence, starting earlier and running steadily throughout the period. In the hands of Charles Meriot and Brigitte Mainz, Merovingian martyr stories have helped us to reassess the character of Christianisation and the development of institutions in northern Gaul in the 7th century. This may prove to be the already significant tip of a larger iceberg, which requires us to rethink the whole of the Merovingian church, and with that, the ways in which the micro-Christendoms of the Latin West developed together between the fall of Rome and the Carolingian Age. We may still have a long way to go before we've escaped the old grand narratives of ecclesiastical and missionary history, but the new ways forward continue to emerge. Thank you.